Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have an email that we're going to start off with here, just one. And it's in reference to an interview that I just have to say we rebroadcast. So we do have to do that once in a while. In this case, it was connected to the fact that I think I conducted personally was involved in 8 different interviews for to kind of strengthen the Science Unscripted team. And when that happens, it's just real life. Once in a while, we have to rerun something. And it was an interview where we went off to Cologne and talked to Marita Jacob about
how to live a meaningful life.
Yeah.
And what effect children, having children, have or has on whether or not your life is meaningful or successful.
Right. Yeah. They measured 2 things in that one. 40,000 people, life satisfaction.
Satisfaction, yeah.
And meeting. And the obviously life satisfaction, some temporary drops for the people who were raising children. It's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of life meaning, it went up. And then it turned into an interesting discussion on what life meaning is in the end and whether we could all hope to look at the versions of ourselves with or without children mm-hmm. through a fictional telescope. We have an email where someone it's not fictional. It's real life. This is from someone whose initials are DS. And wrote, "Dear SU, what it's like living a life without children, no worries, total complete freedom," as opposed to just complete freedom, total complete freedom. "No mortgage ever." I'm not really sure how that factors in because you could have, with or without children, could
kids
have mortgage.
Kids are expensive. That's
yeah.
probably why.
"And at 46, in a financial position to comfortably retire and have enough money in the bank to travel, doing up to 5 major overseas trips a year. Also, do parents not worry about the future world their children are growing up in and what's even more, their grandchildren? I would really worry about that and feel guilty. Love your show. Keep up the good work." For any of you doubting the authenticity of these statements, preparing to retire at 46, I don't know. It's just an email.
Yeah.
They could be true. It could be not true. I do know this fits into a trend that I've paid attention to online. It fascinates me. The FIRE trend. FIRE, financially independent.
Retire early. Right?
Retire early, yeah. Where people strategically map out how early they can retire. And that's, yeah, one of the lives I could have lived and looked at through the telescope I talked about.
Great job, DS, I would say. Good on you for doing that. And it's not only, if you have kids, it's not only worrying about the future, it's worrying about them now.
Yeah.
Oh, for all 3 of them. I got a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old, I'm worried nonstop about them, not only about the future. So you're doing a lot of worrying, a lot of stress. Your energy is completely depleted. But at the end of the day, I think it's all going to be worth it.
That's all you can know. That's all you can know. What I will add here at the end is that Marita Jacob, the sociology professor at the University of Cologne, when we asked her, "Hey, look, there are a lot of people out there who are not having children for very good reasons. And how do they find meaning?" I mean, they already have, many of them. I'm not acting like the only people who can have it are the people who've had kids.
No.
And her suggestion, no, she said it's not a tip. It's more of an idea because it was not evidence-based. But she was saying that you can care for things, like anything that you care for. It could be friends. It could be an institution.
Yeah.
If you volunteer something civic, that can often lead to more meaning in life in the way that they defined it here, which was a valuable and worthwhile time on, mm-hmm. on planet Earth. Anyway, thank you for the email, DS.
Yeah. Every time the Olympics happens, it becomes headlines every time, I think, or at least the last couple. How many condoms are used or are given away at the Olympic Village.
Right.
And yeah, I saw a study this past week and I thought I would mention it because if you were wondering if there is that much sex happening at the Olympics, is it having an effect
on the athletes,
on their performance?
Well, and real quick to the numbers, we have no way of verifying this, right? But according to the, I think official statements from the authorities in Italy, it's the number's always the same. Something like 10,000 condoms
right.
are handed out, and they're gone very quickly. And to be very clear, it sounds like a lot of people they're branded the 2026 Winter Olympics, yeah. Milan Cortina. So people take them as souvenirs. It's
not
just...
Yeah. Of course. You give them to your friends. Here, here's a condom from the 2026 Games.
Not quite a gold medal, but it's something... Yeah. It's also round.
Yeah, they're not necessarily used, but I guess we can assume that some of them are used. We've got athletes in tip-top physical, male and female athletes, all, you know, it's going to happen. Does it affect their performance at the Games? This is a study that was done out of Valladolid in Spain, the University of Valladolid, looking at 21 participants, which is small, but they did their study. It's kind of the gold standard where it split it into two groups and you didn't know whether you were going to be part of the control group or the experimental group. The experimental group masturbated 30 minutes before and the other group didn't. They one of them watched a really boring documentary and the other watched an erotic film. Masturbated to completion, and then they ran them through some physical tests measuring endurance, which is when you're on an exercise bike, it continually gets harder and harder and harder, and you go and go and go until you can't.
To the fail point.
Right, and then you did a grip test. They also did some hormonal tests to see what masturbation, the effect that it has on your body with regard to sports or exercise output production. It is good for you to masturbate 30 minutes before.
That's not the answer I thought you were going to say.
3.2% more endurance, stronger grip strength, testosterone increased, cortisol increased, heart rate increased, which means following the masturbation, you were more prepared. You were ready to go, and that had that positive effect. And also psychologically, the ones who masturbated said that they felt a sense of calm, that they weren't agitated or nervous. They were less nervous than the control group. So if you were wondering whether that has an effect 30 minutes before, this kind of work has been done the night before, but now this is the first time a study has been done immediately before engaging in exercise or physical or sports. It helps.
And if any of you out there are tempted to think, who needs that kind of science? Who's even asking that question? I've heard people say this or suggest that by not engaging in any activity of that kind, either alone or with a partner, that your sports or athletic performance would increase. Like this is a kind
that's
of
a myth. Yeah, that's a myth.
This is a kind of myth that somebody says in a locker room and it spreads to everyone and suddenly everyone's engaging in this group self-experimentation that doesn't have to happen.
Without thinking about it, without it being based on evidence, now we have evidence out there from Valladolid, Spain, saying the contrary.
Yeah, suggesting with a small group that the opposite may be true. On to an announcement, really, that I've been meaning to mention for a while and that has huge, huge global consequences. This is connected to something... Well, it's connected to the fact that nearly half of the children around the world are immunized or have been immunized by an organization that you might not have even really paid attention to or heard of before. This is called Gavi, which stands for the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. It's been around since 2000, public-private. They say, and I think objective observers also agree, that they've immunized roughly 1 billion children around the world or helped, assisted in the immunization of, and prevented 18 million deaths. This is an astonishing number for an organization that's about 26 years old now. Really, really impressive stuff. And we're now looking, they get their funding in 5-year cycles to keep doing what they've been doing so successfully. Mm-hmm. And for 2026 to 2030, that funding cycle, the UK is actually at the top of the list. They're going to send $1.7 billion to them. The Gates Foundation, 1.6, and the United States, 0. And it used to be...
That funding has been frozen.
Yeah. And the last cycle, it was $1.3 billion. Now it's zero. This is a gigantic financial hit to an organization that needs that kind of money.
Which means it won't be able to do some of the work it's doing right now. And that number of the 18 million kids, this means that kids are going to die?
That would be the implication. Yeah. Or kind of no matter how you look at it, that would be the implication. And if you're wondering why that would be the case, is this just, what's the reasoning behind it? I'm going to go back to a statement from the U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services in the United States, RFK Jr. In this case, he was talking about flu vaccines in the U.S., but it's connected to what's happening now. He said that now that the U.S. has removed mercury from all vaccines, we urge global health authorities to follow suit for the protection of children around the world. We urge the World Health Organization and Gavi, this vaccine alliance, to stop their programs of injecting mercury into more than 100 million black and brown babies in developing countries annually.
Mercury.
Yeah.
When he says mercury, injecting mercury, that's wrong. It's thimerosal. It's used as a preservative to keep vaccines safe by not allowing bacteria or other parasites or fungi into the vials of multi-doses of the vaccine.
And that's critical there, because if it's a single-dose vaccine, you're using it once, popping the needle in there once, it's gone.
Then you don't have to worry about it becoming contaminated.
Right. If you have multiple doses in there, it could become contaminated, and those multiple doses are especially useful in developing countries because of refrigeration and just in getting a lot of people into one place over a given weekend or weeks to get them all vaccinated, multiple dose vials with thimerosal.
It means you can vaccinate more people
effectively.
Yes.
Right. And so to be clear here, he's kind of conflating two different things, two different kinds of mercury. When that thimerosal is then taken up into the human body, one of the byproducts is ethyl mercury.
Ethyl mercury.
Ethyl, yeah.
Yes.
And ethyl mercury is processed and flushed out of the human body in about a week. And in the dosage that you would get as a result of a vaccination, it's far less than you would get from the other kind of mercury that you're probably more familiar with,
yeah.
The quote in quotation, the bad mercury. It's in a far lower dosage than you would get in, say, a tuna sandwich. That bad mercury is called methyl mercury, and it's very different than ethyl mercury. For anyone out there wondering, well, you know, how would we know? If it sounds bad, it sounds scary. How would we know if it actually has negative effects on people? Well, on the CDC website, there's a very clear answer to that, because in 2001, the United States stopped using thimerosal in childhood vaccinations. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was looked into is whether, for example, autism or neurodevelopmental diseases, whether there would be an effect, negative or positive. And if there had been a connection, then you would have expected a subsequent drop in those diagnoses. And the opposite happened. Autism diagnoses continued going up despite the removal of thimerosal from the market, at least the U.S. market. So a long way of saying that when you hear people talking about vaccines and mercury, just remember there are two different kinds. Ethyl, which is useful in preventing vaccine contamination, germs from getting into useful, good vaccines.
And there is extensive research that it does not harm the human body. Ethyl mercury itself is a toxin, but the way that it's used in vaccines as a preservative, it is flushed out of the human body because the body doesn't absorb it the way that it does the other kind of mercury, which is methyl mercury. So when you hear politicians or anyone saying that we shouldn't be injecting mercury, it is false. That is a false statement. That is not what is happening.
And unfortunately, in this case, with huge global ramifications, potentially at this point.
One last thing I wanted to talk about, Connor, was a study. They were looking into what happens when you get drunk in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been studied before, the effects of alcohol on the brain long-term. If you've been drinking for a long time, chronic drinkers, your brain shrinks inflammation. It's a great way to damage it. And also the effect of alcohol from one sitting, what happens to your brain when you're drunk. Scientists have looked at what happens to particular parts of the brain, but they've never looked at what happens to the connectivity in the brain, the whole brain, what it looks like when you're drunk. They did that here. University of Minnesota and University of Florida took 21 participants, again, 21.
Mm-hmm.
and in the experimental case, had people have one drink and then put them through an fMRI.
Just one.
Yeah, one drink. Told to keep their eyes open and let their mind wander.
Okay.
And in the other case,
sober,
didn't have a drink. And what they saw when looking at the total brain is there are different nodes in the brain, So the way it connects, let's say you've got highways connecting the different parts of the brain. What they saw was activity was lowered in the connectivity or the way that the parts of the brain were talking to each other and was higher in clusters. So local, high local activity and less global activity. This is the first time I've seen research where they talk about the GABA receptors and alcohol makes them fire off. And what GABA does is it brings your anxiety down. It brings your stress down. It almost puts you into a sedative state, makes you sleepy. That I can understand. I've never thought about alcohol and almost shutting down the communication between your different parts of the brain. Because when you think about anxiety, for instance, or depression, those are two mental problems where there is hyperactive activity between the different modes of the brain, dysfunctional. And what happens when you drink, if the results of this study are correct, is that that activity goes down. So you've got less of these thoughts, sometimes negative thoughts, firing between these different parts of the brain. And for anybody out there who has used alcohol in this way to make those negative thoughts or that activity to go down, this study can absolutely possibly make sense, because what they saw was that the global activity, the activity between the different parts of the brain, went down, and then there were clusters of activity in the local parts, which almost reverts back to like a childlike state where those more complex connections haven't been made yet. You're able to focus more on certain things and repeat yourself a lot and think you're really funny and think and be almost like in a jolly state where you don't have to worry about things as much.
Well, and all of that sounds almost positive, and temporarily it is, right? That's why it's the addictive drug or why it has the addictive capacity it does. But as you said at the very beginning, it has huge long-term ramifications on that organ, on that most important organ that you're saturating.
Of course. Yeah, that's long-term. And what happens was that when you get used to using alcohol that way to make those negative thoughts go away, it gets very hard to stop that, because each time you do it, you don't know, you not only get used to it because you like it, it also neurochemically, the GABA receptor and the dopamine that gets shot out means that you're going to have to drink more of it to get that same effect. That's the scary part about alcohol and using other substances neurochemically to make yourself feel good. It can get out of control.
Right. So they're answering why it feels therapeutic, when in fact what you actually need.
It's a new way to think about it. Yeah,
anxiety or depression or something that needs actual therapy or potentially medication.
Yeah.
That's why it makes you feel that way temporarily.
If you guys want to look at that one, acute alcohol intake disrupts resting state network topology in healthy social drinkers is where you can find it.
If you have anything to say on that, alcohol as a therapy when it probably, I was going to say probably, when it shouldn't be used that way. Mm. Any experience with vaccines that you'd like to tell us about? Or
masturbation and athletic performance?
If you want to go there,
any anecdotes?
You know us. We'll read it. We are su@dw.com. For any of you out there who have heard, probably more recently than not, a debate about the biological differences between the sexes, between biological males and biological females, one part of that is obviously the human brain, right? It's got to be.
I can remember arguing with Laura Stegemann in 10th grade.
Who's Laura?
Who's smarter, girls or boys?
Well, of course. Wait, in 10th grade?
10th grade.
Okay. Well, in this case, we're going to go back to an earlier phase of life than 10th grade, because some researchers out of Cambridge have taken one of the earliest looks possible at the human body and the human brain as it develops, and found out, yes, there are differences worth talking about.
Hi, my name is Yumna Khan. I am a PhD student at the University of Cambridge, and recently I've published a paper looking at sex differences in brain development early on in life, so from mid-pregnancy up until about 1 month after birth.
And from mid-pregnancy up until about a month after birth, what was the kind of primary conclusion you found with regard to the human brain?
So our main finding was in terms of brain size. So on average, it appeared that males seem to be showing faster brain growth compared to females beginning during prenatal brain development. And this was seen all across the brain. So it wasn't necessarily specific to any particular region, but it was an effect all across the brain.
And how much bigger or how much faster did the male brain develop compared to the female brain prenatal and postnatal?
We kind of see the growth trajectories or the growth curves changing more and more over time. So it starts off with a small difference, but it does then sort of increase more and more across the prenatal period and postnatally as well. So even when we look at other research in children and adults, that difference sort of continues to increase. So the main thing is that the prenatal sex differences, they're sort of this baseline, or they set this baseline, but then those differences do increase over time. So they're not super, super large just quite yet, but they set an important foundation for future sex differences to build on.
I'm just going to sort of paraphrase some of the comments that I did see on the internet in connection with your study. And they were being sarcastic, but they're like, yeah, bigger brains, go men or boys. They must be smarter as a result of this. Is there anything at all that can be said about a larger brain either early in life or even later in life? Does it have an effect at all on cognition, on behavior, or on anything?
Yes. So this is actually a very, very nuanced question. But basically, first of all, research around the area is very, very mixed. But yes, some meta-analyses have suggested a small but weak association between brain size and intelligence levels. Again, this is a weak association, so it would only explain a very, very small percentage of variance in overall intelligence scores, but it does exist. However, when it comes to sex differences in something like, say, intelligence, we don't typically see differences in intelligence levels when we're looking at total IQ scores.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, males have slightly bigger brains, but aren't necessarily more intelligent. Have I understood what you've said there correctly?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, so some studies even show that earlier on in development, females perform better on certain cognitive tasks and perform higher on IQ tests on average.
Is it as simple as the fact that as adults, males tend to be larger than females, and hence that brain size, that makes sense, it lines up?
So actually, most of these studies looking at brain size, what we usually tend to do is we control for body size. So we take into account body weight and body height, and any sex differences that are typically reported are after accounting for body size. So they're independent of body size. And the finding is that on average, yes, males do tend to have larger brains even after accounting for body size.
Yeah, I'm just wondering here, I might never get this chance again to ask a researcher, what is the difference between the male and female brain? Are there differences, or Can I even ask that question today?
Yeah. No, I think it's a super important question. And one of the things that's really important to understand here is the brain is not sexually dimorphic. And when I say sexually dimorphic, what I mean is, like, if you look at the reproductive organs, they're present in two different forms in males and females. That's sexually dimorphic. The brain isn't like that. Essentially, we have the same brain, but any difference that we do see is in group averages. So measuring something like brain volumes, for example, you see lots of overlap between males and females, lots of overlap. But then when you look at the averages, there's a slight on average difference. So yes, while we do see these on average differences when we're looking at means, there's no such thing per se as a male brain or a female brain. It's still the exact same brain, just with slight differences.
This study was conducted at the University of Cambridge and at the Autism Research Center. Could you maybe elaborate for our listeners out there what you're looking for here specifically and why it fits within the Autism Research Center?
Yes. So we know that sex differences are present in the prevalence of many psychiatric and neurodevelopmental conditions. So, for example, things like anxiety and depression are on average more common in females, whereas neurodevelopmental conditions like ADHD and autism are more common in males. There's also sex differences in presentation. So even when present in both sexes, these conditions can present themselves very differently in males and females. And it's hypothesized that these sex differences exist because there are some sort of early emerging sex differences in brain development between males and females, which leads to males becoming more likely to developing certain conditions and females becoming more likely to developing others. So this type of research basically allows us to better understand why there are sex differences in psychiatry. It's the very first step, but this holds really important implications for things like how can we improve diagnosis, tailor diagnosis better towards males and females, or how can we improve support strategies and tailor them better towards males and females.
And that was Yumna Han talking to us from Cambridge in the UK. And one thing that she mentioned after we'd finished up our interview with her was that there's a field of research or a hypothesis at this point that the differences she mentioned between male and female brains, not just the size, but the gray matter, white matter, that those may be kind of the opposite of what we think they are, that they actually make us more similar than different. That, for example, if we had exactly the same brains and I got a big shot of testosterone, just to massively simplify, and someone next to me got a massive shot of estrogen in that same brain, that without these differences, we might be very dissimilar. But that because of these differences in white and gray matter, it actually brings us closer together. I thought that was just a fascinating way to even think or speculate about the human brain. And look at it in a different way.
Yeah, the next time you guys are at a cocktail party and the topic comes up, what's the difference between the male and female brain, or why are they so different? You can just say, I just heard on Science Unscripted, what? Brains aren't sexual organs, right? They're the same.
Yeah.
They're the same thing. That's what she said. I'm gonna tell that to my daughters at some point. I don't know whether it's tomorrow or
at a cocktail party in the future.
Maybe I'm at a cocktail party with them. You never know.
Yeah. In any case, a fascinating study. If you have anything to say on it or anything else we've talked about on the show, su@dw.com.
Science Unscripted. DW, made for minds.